right? And this loss has never been caused by the death of anyone before that. What is that? It's very obvious. مِنَ النُّبُوَّةِ وَالْأَنْبَاءِ وَأَخْبَارِ السَّمَاءِ. Prophet was the last prophet. It's our belief that the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was the last prophet. With his death, revelation was cut off for humanity. This is a great loss for humanity, right? The guidance that was coming from the heavens, from God Almighty through the Prophet Muhammad, was cut off at his death. And there's nothing more grave and solemn for human beings than this. In continuation, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, your death was special. Your death was grave. Your death was distinct. To the extent that it was so grave that in comparison to it, the deaths of other people, you know, became easy to bear. And it occurred at a time where everybody, all humanity, right, they became, you know, affected by it. They became sad and solemn at it. In continuation, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if you had not commanded us to be patient and you know, prohibited us from, causing a commotion at the death of people, you know, we would have shed great amount of tears at you. We would have expressed, you know, we would have gone crazy at your death, right? But thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the death of the Prophet Muhammad and its effects for humanity in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
The Spotlight. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has spoken at the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. His speech was directed at the promotion of peace and justice. In the same breath, he slammed countries that promoted this notion, yet inaction did the opposite, like the U.S. and its warmongering policies. In this edition of the program, we will look at some of the points that Iran's president has made and why Iran spoke from a position of strength compared to the U.S. when it comes to making a world a better place and a more peaceful place to live in. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. Also joining us is Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Said Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. Obviously, there's many things that Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said during his address at the UNGA, which was his first time there, making the statements in the speech that he made. Let's talk about how he said that Iran was not seeking an atomic weapon. He made sure that something that was known before, that it got highlighted again, and that it was a fatwa coming from Imam Khamenei, and demanded U.S. guarantees that it would abide by any JCPOA sanctions removal deal. Why do you think he repeated that and deemed that to be important to highlight in his speech?
Because the Islamic Republic of Iran has some principles, and unlike the kind of immoral politics that we're used to across the globe, we tend to find that politics is a dirty word, fundamentally, because nobody says what they mean. And the Americans, of course, have demonstrated that within the JCPOA. The Europeans have demonstrated their ill will in that regard during the negotiations with Iran also. But the Islamic Republic of Iran has stuck very solidly to what it said, even though nobody else was abiding by the JCPOA. And the Americans walked out without even a flinch unilaterally. Nonetheless, Iran tried its best for at least a year, if not more, to comply with what was an agreement which effectively had already been made redundant. And since then, it's been a huge amount of patience shown on the part of the Iranian negotiators, the Iranian establishment, to try and keep this JCPOA scenario alive. In reality, you could very strongly argue that the Islamic Republic of Iran doesn't need the JCPOA. They've done quite well, thank you very much, through resistance economy, through a greater direction towards the east, the rise of the Eurasian axis, the increasing kind of look away from the West. Particularly with this establishment, what you're finding is even less traction than the previous one, where there was a possibility that they were leaning towards the West and overcompensating, trying to really win over the hearts and minds of the Western powers. The truth of the matter is the Western powers want one thing from Iran. They want the absolute annihilation, destruction, and termination of the Islamic Republic's establishment. They don't want the existence of this establishment, unless, of course, tomorrow Ayatollah Khamenei comes along, bends his knee, bows to the neoliberalists and the neocons and the Anglo-American Zionist empire, does everything that Israel wants them to do, hands over the wealth of Iran, and resubjugates its people to the greater money mafias of the world. You know, unless Iran really wants to do that, unless the Iranian public wants that, unless the Iranian establishment wants that, I'm afraid what the alternative is a sort of ongoing enmity and an ongoing guarantee that the West will do its level best to try and destroy Iran.
Elijah Magnier, there were so many things that I could have started out this program with, but I chose that one. And let me see if you agree with me, because I wanted to make an analogy with how Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi talked about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, saying that you have 2% of the world's nuclear activity taking place in Iran, but yet you have 35% of all inspections, ratio-wise, taking place on Iran's civilian nuclear program. And then you compare that with the way that Joe Biden came out when he first started his speech, where he said, we have to defend Ukraine, we got to stand up for them, which all translates into this military conflict, a prolonging. Is that a correct analogy to make in the way that Iran is promoting peace through the statements that we saw, where that notion and justice was peppered or was sprayed in the Iranian president's statement as opposed to what Joe Biden was saying?
Well, indeed, it is correct. There is also more I could add to it, is in the last 43 years, Iran never declared war on any country, while the Americans declared war in Afghanistan, on Iraq, on Syria, on Lebanon, on Yemen, and supporting the Saudis in the war in Yemen. So we see that there is no similarity between what Iran is offering to the neighbors and what the Americans are offering to the world. The Americans are only talking now and very busy with their war against Russia and very preoccupied with gathering all the Western forces in country, particularly the EU, behind it, not concerned really what's happening to to its allies, because they are the ones suffering. And Iran is saying, I'm ready to abide by the JCPOA if you offer the deal, even if you offer enough guarantees. While the Americans are talking from a position they are out of the JCPOA, they only offering wars, they offering weapons to Ukraine, they pushing the Europeans to offer more weapons. Nobody here in Europe has any more weapons in their warehouses. So any real war, they are in real trouble. And the Americans are producing more weapons just to send to Ukraine, because it is a Western war against Russia. So they need Iran at the moment because Iran is their only hope, particularly when President Vladimir Putin announced that he is calling upon a part of reservists and he is willing to continue the war. Now, what the Europeans are going to do without the Russian oil that they are going to start imposing sanction on the 5th of December? Of course, they have Iran, they have Venezuela, and with both countries, there are sanctions imposed by the U.S. and particularly by the U.S., and nobody else dares to make business with Iran, particularly the EU, who did not, as your guest rightly said, abide by the agreement of the JCPOA and did not do any step to respect their deal and their part of the deal. So what we have today is a country that the U.S. is leading the world, but is leading the world toward more wars and more destructions. And Iran is saying, I can help you, but give me the enough insurance to return to the JCPOA, but I'm still in, but I will abide by it if you show the real intention that you are trustworthy. And
sure.
There is no point in Iran talking at the UN General Assembly because a quarter of the world there are pro-US and the two other two-thirds of the world is really not against the U.S., but not with the U.S., and preferring to stay either on the side or on the side of Iran.
Right. Well, I'm wondering how those people reacted, Hossein Mohsen Abbas, and how maybe you reacted also, Hossein Mohsen Abbas, when we heard Ebrahim Raisi speaking, and he was speaking about some of the issues that we're going to hopefully get to in this program, like unilateralism and the way that the U.S. has gained political leverage through controlling institutions over other countries. And then all of a sudden, when he starts talking about martyred General Qasem Soleimani and brings up a placard of him at the podium there at the UN General Assembly for the world to see that it was the U.S. that assassinated this general that was at the forefront of eradicating terrorists from the region and even beyond. What impression did you get from that? And what do you think people thought, that this was the U.S. that did it? And here you have Ebrahim Raisi raising that point.
Well, I think it's interesting that Raisi went for the humanitarian card. I mean, it's usually a weapon that often the West tries to use against Iran by inventing all sorts of bloated arguments about how despotic Iran is. I mean, of course, that's what's pumped out by most of the Western media, Western propaganda. Most Westerners haven't been to Iran for decades, if ever at all. So a lot of this propaganda can stick. But for Iran to take hold of that particular issue and to raise Haji Qasem Soleimani's placard is very significant, because what Iran is pointing to is that this region, as long as it has the American interference in the way they are prepared to interfere, you know, with their industrial military complex, with their sort of color revolutions, with their supporting of despotic, illegitimate leaders around the Gulf states, with their support of the Mossad and of Israel's Odin Yinon plan to expand across the whole of the Middle East, how on earth can you possibly have peace? The likes of, Haji Qasem Soleimani, who were killed, not even in action. He was killed as a diplomat, traveling on the invitation of the Iraqi government, and the Americans didn't even respect that. What this shows is that the American regime has dropped so low that they actually don't really respect any international law. There is no rule of law that they really respect. So human rights violations, I think this is where Ebrahim Raisi was trying to hit, was that, look, do you really want a world where we have one bully, one unilateral bullying power that makes everybody do exactly what it wants? It is okay to plunder, rape, pillage, destroy, kill, murder, maim by their own admission. Don't forget, Mike Pompeo was very, very famously on air admitting that they steal, plunder, and do all sorts of other murderous acts, and they do it gleefully. And this is what the CIA's job is, et cetera. It's the job of the Mossad. It's the job of the MI6. So when you're faced with a force which knows no morality, which knows no real human rights, but touts democracy and human rights as its major reason for being in West Asia, exposing them with what they did to Qasem Soleimani is symbolic of what they've been doing against the Yemenis, against the Syrians, against the Libyans, the devastation, the ruin, the destruction they leave behind when they don't get their own way, and the theft of the gold and the oil and whatnot. Well, that's de rigueur. Whether they destroy a nation or not, they're going to steal those anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think the plea to the world, even though as my colleague rightly pointed out, the plea to the world goes almost on deaf ears, because most of these nations are puppets or fear economic sanctions from America. And again, that terrorism of an economic kind, the psychological warfare terrorism that they engage in, the manipulation behind the scenes, these are all part of a war which Iran has been at the front line of against America ever since 1979. And now, of course, the Russians and all sorts of the Chinese as well, perhaps, are going to be gradually embroiled by the absolutely psychotic behavior of the Anglo-Zionist American empire.
So what I'm curious about, Elijah Magnier, is that when you sift through and dissect what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, and then you try to look for things there that maybe are weak at any sense of the word in terms of what he's trying to present, and this is not to just compare Iran's President's statement to the U.S. statement, it seems like Iran and Raisi, on behalf of Iran, were speaking on a position of strength, because what he was saying was, in essence, a world that should be void of all these different injustices and negativity that's being pursued and then executed by the U.S., and he named some examples. Did you get that feeling at all in terms of the way that Iran has conducted itself vis-a-vis the U.S.?
I get this impression from the first day Raisi was nominated the president. So we've seen the Americans were playing a bit cool, thinking that Iran is going to rush to ask, please return to the JCPOA negotiation. We saw how Raisi waited for 5 months before starting the negotiation. That's one. Two, the Iranian negotiator refused to have the U.S. flag in the room where the negotiation was conducted with the Europeans on behalf of the Americans, and never accepted a direct meeting or direct negotiation with the Americans. The three, we see that today when Iran is saying, I want to prove that you're going to stay in the JCPOA, and you're not going just to sign the deal, and then after that you start imposing sanctions under different reasons that are really a way for the U.S. to reimpose more sanctions. So we see Iran, had Iran wanted to sign the JCPOA, it would have been signed months ago or even a year ago. But Iran is looking after the interest of the Iranian population by saying either we sign a good deal or no deal at all. But at the same time, Iran is sending a message to the world saying, even if I don't sign the deal, and I am still in the JCPOA agreement, it doesn't mean that I'm going to go and make a bomb, although I have the knowledge to do it, because I've reached 60%. I have all the advanced centrifuge of the 8th and 9th generation, and I can do it whenever I want. It's not up to you to decide if I do the bomb or not, because I will do it if I want to, but I don't want to. So this is the position of strength. At the United Nations, Raisi is talking from a position of strength, is aware what the world is going through, and saying, I am not signing the deal, although the Iranian negotiator is here in the UN, ready to negotiate, but I'm not going to sign any deal. That is a position of strength.
Sure. Well, the U.S. has always tried to alienate Iran, Seyed Mohsen Abbas, and I believe through one of the statements that our guest there, Elijah Magnier, said before, that I recall, he said that Iran is going into this General Assembly from a position of strength, coming high off of the SCO summit that was held in Uzbekistan. And there, when you have Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi in the presence of world leaders speak and be present there, then you can't be isolated. Now, the thing is, and I'm curious about this, say, Mohsen Abbas, do you think that there are many countries who would like to take this stance against, not just against the U.S., but to push back against some of the U.S. ways and methods that it has used and speak up against it like Iran has done, but they're afraid to do that because they might be subject to U.S. focus, whether it's sanctions or foreign policy?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the overwhelming majority in the world are deep down sick and tired of American bullying and threats. I mean, that's how they essentially operate their empire. They threaten people through, as I mentioned, color revolutions, economic threats, through military threat. They have done this for decades, of course, and now they're masters at it. But the time is running out, because what we're seeing increasingly now is the confidence of the likes of China and Russia and Iran, three of the major economic powers, now beginning to talk about moving away from the dollar. This never happened before. They're talking about creating new means of trading with each other away from the SWIFT banking system. There's talk of opening up that $5 billion credit line which Russia wants to offer Iran. The Chinese are not worried about sanctions when they're doing deals with Iran, Iraq, and others, going into the multi-millions around building the Belt and Road Initiative. All of this basically is saying to the Americans, look, you can't have it all your own way. A multipolar world is a much better place, rather than the kind of dictatorial unipolar world that you've been dreaming of. And I think that that's where the world is heading. The Eurasian axis, I believe, is an inevitability. The Americans are making it an inevitability by really scoring own goal after own goal. They could have a softer policy towards Iran or Russia. They could share the cake. But the trouble is they've got so greedy, and they've got had it so their own way for so long, that they really are drunk on the using military means and other means and their other cunning tactics to see if they can coerce, scare, and co-opt people into doing what they want. And all these other powers are saying, you can see China's policy. They tend to do fair deals. They don't go in and invade countries. They crack deals and they stick to those deals. They offer fair recompense in terms of building infrastructures of nations where they get resources. You could argue the wrongs and rights of that, but nonetheless, they're not imperialists in that formal sense of just raping and looting and installing leaders that they think will be conforming. So there's this rival power, or a series of rival powers, which are now coming up, and they will challenge America, and it will create a world that will be in flux for a considerable time yet.
Sure. Well, this world order, that's a new world order, was expressed by the Iranian president, Elijah Magnier, in a few different ways. One of them was through denouncing unilateralism, in which Raisi said that American foreign policy, he said over the past century, had actually proven that the unilateralistic approach that the U.S. had actually pursued was at the self-interest and at the expense of partnerships. Do you think countries like, say, Mohsen Abbas said, don't speak up, but they really are sick and tired of it, and they perhaps are the ones that Raisi are talking about, that they feel that way?
I fully agree with Mohsen Abbas. What he said is really the truth, and this is the reality today. And we've seen that in the meeting during the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where half of the world population representative and leaders were present to talk about the exchange with their goods and trade with local currency, and they were outside the U.S. orbit. Yes, indeed, the U.S. is challenged in its unilateralism. It's still strong. We should not think that the U.S. is not going to defend itself and is not going to cause more harm and to be more harsh than it is today, because it's going to defend its throne and its position worldwide. And to do that is going to cause more damage to the world, and it is causing it, mainly to its allies in Europe and in Africa and other people who are in need of support, particularly in Afghanistan, confiscating $9 billion, etc. So, yes, the U.S. is going to defend it's unilateralism, but it is challenged and is no longer going to hold for very long.
Last point that time allows us to make, say, Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking at the point that the U.S. President Joe Biden made on the use of veto power, where he said that countries should refrain from the use of this veto power. I'm wondering, when he says that, doesn't he realize then why does the U.S. use that veto power when it comes to Israel?
Well, the double standards are laughable, aren't they? This is what Aga Raisi talked about, the double standards of these Western powers. And they know it, but this, of course, they get away with murder because they can. And literally, by supporting Israel and doing what they did in terms of planting that kind of cuckoo in the nest in the Middle East, what they've done is they've perpetuated a war and a conflict which would never have been there. I mean, take Israel out of the equation there, and the odds are that you really wouldn't have the kind of turmoil and chaos and conflict. That's all created fundamentally and deliberately by the money mafias who wanted the oil and Israel to sit there as their policeman, and they continue to be hell-bent on doing that. Islamic Republic of Iran was the first to stand up genuinely in a real way. Yes, you had Jamal Abdel Nasser and all the previous wars that were kicked off. But in reality, the first constructive and really long-standing opposition to the tyranny of Zionism and Anglo-American Zionism has come from Iran. That makes it another target. And I don't think Iran is not going to let go of that. They're going to demand justice for the oppressed, and not least of all for their own people in Iran.
Thank you so much. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, a pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Wa awhayna ila Musa an asri bi'ibadi innakum.
And we inspired to Moses, "Travel by night with my servants. Indeed, you will be pursued."
Dear listeners, as you were with us, we were discussing 52nd and 53rd verses of this Surah Ash-Shu'ara. وَأُوحَيْنَا إِلَى مُوسَىٰ أَنْ أَسْرِ بِعِبَادِي إِنَّكُمْ مُتَّبَعُونَ. And we revealed unto Moses, saying, Go you forth with my servants by night, because verily you will be pursued. فَأَرْسَلَ فِرْعَوْنَ فِي الْمَدَائِنِ حَاشِرِينَ. Then Pharaoh sent heralds into the cities. In order to sum up the different verses of this chapter about the invitation of Prophet Moses so far, we can actually conclude that the objective Prophet Moses was pursuing and following can be divided into three parts. The first part was the invitation of Pharaoh and bringing miracle to him. The second part was the fact that these wizards and sorcerers, were gathered around this prophet of the Almighty Allah. They believed in him and what happens afterwards. The third part is mobilizing the Bani Israel, the children of Israel, and then these were followed and pursued by these disbelievers and the people of Pharaoh, that led to the people of Pharaoh being drowned in the ocean. Now back to some points regarding these two verses. This verse, as you can see, it says, We revealed unto Moses, saying, Go forth with my servants by night. And أَسْرِ بِعِبَادِي إِنَّكُمْ مُتَّبَعُونَ. When there is no way of reasoning, logic, and bringing arguments for the invitation of people and some arrogant ones to truth, it is the time to use force. So the Almighty Allah orders his prophet to move these people and to save them, and this leads to the people of Pharaoh being drowned in the water, those disbelievers. The second point is that all the plans and actions and objectives of the prophets are based on the divine source. وَأَوْحَيْنَا إِلَى مُوسَىٰ, the first part of the verse says, and we revealed unto Moses. The third point, you can use anything, specifically the dark time of the night, to get away from them. When you are ordered to fight against the enemy, you have to try to make the most of the surroundings around you. The fourth point, if you cannot change the society you are living in, you are ordered to move in order to save yourself and the ones among you. Another point is that the Almighty Allah always saves his true servants, because in this point, there were some people who believed in Pharaoh, but they wanted to change, but they did not have the chance yet. So the Almighty Allah orders his prophet to mobilize and move these people from that society. Anyway, Moses, Prophet Moses, is ordered by the Almighty Allah to mobilize those people, and it is clear that the movement of such a huge number of people cannot be kept hidden for a long time. So Pharaoh sent spies to inform him about this event.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this work. Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The Holy Quran continues about this event. فَأَرْسَلَ فِرْعَوْنُ فِي الْمَدَائِنِ حَاشِرِينَ. Then Pharaoh sent heralds into the cities. There is a kind of implication about the word hashr, which has a connotation of gathering, mobilizing, and moving. Of course, in the conditions of that time, delivering the message to all cities of Egypt needed considerable time, but it is natural that this message reached to near cities very fast, and the ready forces moved immediately, and they formed a small army. Other forces also joined them gradually in order to fight against these true believers. They also used some propagations, some of which we will mention later on with the next verses. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the World with Reporters.
Palestinians rallied in Gaza following the Friday prayer to condemn Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Protesters condemned the Israeli provocative measures, vowing to protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. In recent days, Israeli regime forces have increased their presence near Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays. Dozens of Jewish settlers were also allowed to storm the holy shrine and perform religious rituals. Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, emphasizing that any provocative move against the sacred site will only infuriate Palestinians.
The Zionist criminal enemy is playing with fire and gunpowder that will only explode in its face. The enemy must not forget the sword of Al-Quds battle. If the Zionists continue to desecrate Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, we will wage bigger battles against them.
Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes who normalized ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against Al-Quds.
Those Arab and Islamic countries who normalize their ties with the Zionist enemy are encouraging it to violate and desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. Those countries have lost their moral compass and must correct their mistakes before it's too late.
Protesters slammed British Prime Minister Liz Truss for promising Israeli regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid to consider relocating the British embassy to Al-Quds. Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the eternal capital of Palestine.
We came here today to support Al-Aqsa and to say to the whole world that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. We also want to condemn the British Prime Minister's statements about relocating the British embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds.
Palestinians have also condemned the international community's silence on Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Analysts say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds and Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The pressure from the cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs, due in part to the war in Ukraine, is pushing more and more Britons into poverty, among them people with jobs. Across the nation, business after business has also closed up shop. More could follow. The government's answer, unleashing tens of billions of dollars to protect businesses from rising energy costs. But for many, such measures don't go far enough.
People are still suffering quite big energy and inflation, you know, and real wage cuts. But not if you're at the top end. You're actually going to be delighted with your extra 5% tax cut on your £1 million salary. I mean, it is ludicrous.
A global shortage of essentials from fuel to flour have seemingly made everything more expensive. Inflation in the UK stands at just under 10%, the highest in 40 years and highest across all G7 countries. In response, the Bank of England has raised interest rates, the cost of borrowing, to their highest in more than a decade to try and slow down people's spending and bring down prices.
The government is moving in a different direction, slashing taxes to get people to spend more. Good news for businesses on, for example, high street, but bad news for inflation.
Now, Mr. Speaker, this brings me to the cap on bankers' bonuses.
New Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng has announced cuts to taxes on richest individuals and the biggest companies, along with lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses. He and his prime minister's theory is that if the rich are allowed to get richer, instead of shouldering more of the nation's tax burden, everyone will benefit. And it has a name, trickle-down economics. Very few economists think it's a good idea.
I don't think this is going to be received well by the British public. What we want is an improved health service, dealing with social care, and this is not the time to be cutting tax on the wealthy like this. It is, as I say, astonishingly inept.
In the past 10 years of Conservative government, the UK has experienced stagnated productivity, investment and wages. Many are questioning whether this government can really turn the tide on years of economic decline. Saeed Puriza, London.
The eight-year anniversary of the September 21st Yemeni revolution was marked in the Yemeni capital with a massive parade. In previous years, people used to flock the streets to celebrate the day all across the country. This year, Yemen's armed forces were the ones to march the streets. A broad range of advanced equipment such as missiles, unmanned aerial vehicles, and air defense systems were also put on display. Many in Yemen believe that the country's military development today is only a result of the revolution. A spokesman for the Yemeni military said that this year's parade is a warning to the Saudi-led coalition to end the war and stop its aggression.
We are awaiting the orders of Sayed Abdel Malik to take our positions on the military fronts in order to liberate our lands from every foreign invader.
A UN-backed ceasefire was signed back in April to end hostilities and pave the way for peaceful dialogue. Despite this, the Saudi government continues to impose an economic blockade on its impoverished neighbor. The kingdom's actions are also jeopardizing efforts for peace.
The ceasefire agreement is set to expire on October 2nd, and if not extended, could lead to the resumption of war. The Ansar Allah leader has already said that the Yemeni army and allied fighters are prepared for any scenario. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi wrapped up his first appearance at the United Nations General Assembly with a question and answer session with Western media. A range of subjects were covered. Raisi said that Iran's recent admittance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will be mutually beneficial for all members. In reference to the anti-Iran terror group, the MKO, he rhetorically asked the West, "Why do you keep chanting slogans about fighting against terrorism while housing, giving support, and giving safe haven to them?" He demanded that all Palestinians finally be allowed to vote in referendums and in a transparent manner to decide their fate. Regarding the JCPOA, Raisi emphasized the important issue that matters today is sanctions relief. He continued, "Iran's need for guarantees is due to the bitter experience of America's prior noncompliance with the accord. The only side that kept living up to their side of the bargain was the Islamic Republic of Iran." While on the election campaign last year, one of Raisi's key themes was the idea that the world is not just the West.
"Our foreign policy is based on engagement with everyone, Eastern as well as Western. The previous administration targeted the West a bit more, but now we have adopted a more balanced approach. Any country which wants to have engagement with us, we will certainly pave the way to work with them, and with a priority to our neighboring countries."
Raisi's first speech at the United Nations seemed to fall on deaf ears in much of the Western media, even though it was full of progressive political ideals, such as the duty to help neighboring countries in hardship, the total refusal to obtain nuclear weapons, and the rejection of capitalism over morality.
"Arrogance. Some countries see themselves as more than or superior to others, perhaps because of their financial or military capabilities, and this is a true cause of oppression."
Many believe that few countries are as unobjectively and negatively portrayed by the Western mainstream media as Iran. Raisi's press conference was a chance for Western reporters to consider the Iranian view. Many hope their coverage will be more balanced in the future. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
"There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same."
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the US certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
And they think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades, never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along. And they've caused so much grief here. And most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab Army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing to Press TV how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria. But thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Venise, along with military attaches from different embassies. To attend this ceremony, dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
Time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans